This is Kathleen Sabo, and we're continuing our discussion on race. It's July 25th. We had a call-in program. Our guest still in the studio with me kindly. We've lost Catherine McGill. She had to leave. But we've got UNM Professor Ricky Lee Allen, Albuquerque consultant Susanna Rinderly, and we have Tanya Covington, Executive Director of Peacemakers Consulting. So one of the things we were remarking on as the show ended were the callers and what we experienced. So, Ricky, and then you stayed in the room and you talked a little bit to me. So talk about the callers that we experienced a little bit. Not to cast aspersions on them, just to remark.
Remark on the patterns. I mean, I've been doing this, doing anti-racist education in higher ed for over 15 years now. So there's not much I haven't encountered, that people say or respond to. I just think it's interesting when a group of folks wants to claim to be individuals, yet the responses they have are so predictable, and there's such a predictable pattern to those responses. And that's sometimes the way that a sort of groupness works. And I don't think like when I had classes with white students who tended to, argue with me usually through the first half of the semester, denying, arguing, trying to, put it back on me like I'm the problem. But their responses were collective. They acted as a group. But at the same time, I don't think that they – although sometimes it was true, but I don't think they met outside of class and said, okay, when he says this, I want you to say that.
Right.
But it came from a certain groupness, mm-hmm. right, a certain investment in a certain group status that one – may have some understanding of, but has sort of repressed that, the knowledge of that. And the other thing about, sort of the emotion and energy I heard in people's voices and that question I asked about that. I mean, I don't think that the emotions, I know when people have race dialogues, they want to say, well, let's just have a calm, rational conversation. That's because we know it gets emotional. But we never talk about where the emotions come from.
Where do they come from?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of, I'm certain the whole group wants to talk this, but one thing I would say is that, one thing I know is that it's hard to get emotional about something you have no understanding of or no knowledge of. I mean, why would you get upset if you have no knowledge of what somebody's telling you? Like you go into an anti-racist training, for example, and someone is saying there's white privilege, that if you go to a bank that, someone looks at you a certain way and you might get certain advantages in a loan or buying a house. Or as a student walking into a classroom, the teacher, professor will respond to you differently. Why would you get upset about that if you had no idea that that was possible? I mean, it has to come from, there has to be some kind of awareness that what they're saying is true and that you already knew it. You just didn't know that maybe they knew it and they're exposing you. Like they're exposing this thing that you've become sort of shameful about.
You're feeling defensive perhaps
because,
on some level.
Because you've had, in order to keep going around the world getting these benefits and seeing that you're getting advantages that others don't, and basically you're pretending to be someone you're not. You know that you're not this superior being. You're just getting things that other people don't get. And there's nothing that's going to cause a person more shame than pretending to be something you're not to get things unjustly. Mm. It's a deep moral problem that is going to come out. So when people challenge you on that, you're going to do anything to try to prevent being that inside of you being seen. You'll make absurd claims. You'll say things you know that aren't true. You'll get angry at people to try to get them to stop. You do all sorts of things to try to make that feeling go away.
Gitan, you wanted to add on to that?
Yeah, I think I totally agree with what Ricky says. In doing workshops for 25 years, I can definitely I have the exact same experience. And a part of it is that their reason for the emotional response is there's a stake in it. I always look at it also. I'm also a mediator. And one of the things that I tell people is the most contentious disagreements that people have is when it's a disagreement with somebody that there is some sort of a relationship with, mm-hmm. or that we think there should be a relationship with. If you're walking on the street and somebody who you don't know comes up and tells you that the outfit that you're wearing is incredibly ugly, you might be a little bit upset, but you're not going to be really upset because that's somebody you don't know and you probably will never see again. But if your best friend says that to you, mm. you're going to have a totally different response because that's somebody you have a connection with and you want to keep that connection. So you've now are going to want to resolve whatever that is that's going on. And I feel like the same thing happens. White people get emotional because they know on some level that yes, what it is true. And also they feel like they know that there's some responsibility there and that there should be, we should all be having some sort of a connection because we live in this country and are in this same society. And so if I say to you, you've done something that has an adverse effect on me, and you're not the worst human being in the world, you're going to care about that. No, it wasn't me or what have you. And that's where a lot of the emotionality comes in. And what tends to happen, and this is some of the difficulty in doing the work, is trying to get people to sort of hold off or on that just long enough to be able to hear what the other person is saying. It's awfully hard to listen when you're in that hyper-emotional state.
Well, and before we move to Susanna, do you want to say something about what you noticed about the callers or the pattern of calls?
Well, one of the things that we were talking about was that there was the majority of the callers were men, and that a lot of them were defensive. And a part of that, I feel like, has to do with what came out of the Trayvon Martin verdict, is that this was about stand your ground and about white people and white men most particularly feeling like they need to protect themselves and be strong and that all of that stuff about male privilege and white privilege being put together of, well, of course we have the right to protect ourselves from anything that we feel, think, or believe is a threat to us.
Mm. Susanna, you want to add something? And I'm going to ask you, when you do add, talk about the reptilian brain a little bit, because I know that kicks in a lot. So
oh,
go
wow.
ahead. Start
There's
with
so many places to
well,
go
know,
with
that. Well, I know, but start with whatever you want to say
I'll see if I can thread that in. So I totally agree with Tanya and Ricky. I think what I would add to the discussion is sort of what I touched on in the show, which is, I think, a very profound question to ask white people and for us white people to ask ourselves is, what if it were true?
Okay, give us
what
an example.
What if it were true that all of the things that Ricky and Tanya also were talking about in terms of the policies that our country has had in place, ways that we enjoy privilege as white people, and not just in the past but in the present, ways that white people benefit from a system that was set up to give us advantages, even though we in our own personal families and backgrounds may never have owned slaves. I come from a bunch of peasants. The white side of my family is all very working class peasants, but I still benefit from that system. And what if those 85% of African Americans that thought the verdict were unjust had something there? What if it actually is true that someone like President Obama, who's actually biracial and Ivy League educated and the President of the United States, has experienced the same things that African-American men of lower socioeconomic and middle class experience? What if all of that were true? That is severely disrupting, I think, to a person's sense of self, to a person's sense of identity, to what we have been taught to believe about our country and what we're about and our values. It really shows a picture that's different. There's a disconnect between who we believe ourselves to be and who we want to be and who we're actually being. And that's very difficult to face from a psychological perspective. I think also a piece that's at play, also kind of from the emotional piece, and I think I'm going to go into the downstairs brain now, which is that white people have suffered too. Racism has hurt and does hurt white people, and particularly white people of lower socioeconomic status. And I don't think we do a very good job culturally at acknowledging pain and empathizing with pain. And so I think it's very challenging for white people to be empathetic. And there's actually an interesting study that I just read in a couple weeks ago that white people actually feel less empathy for black people's pain than white people's pain. And there's a whole bunch of reasons. But it was actually a clinical study. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I won't go into that. But until we are able to get empathy for our pain and have and receive empathy for our pain, I think we have a block and a resistance to really acknowledging, seeing, believing, and feeling other people's pain. And I think the downstairs brain, when I say downstairs brain, I'm talking about our very ancient reptilian brain, one of the first parts of our brain that formed, which basically is the three F's, fight, flight, and procreate. And it's very good at filtering. We're constantly filtering. There are 2 million pieces of information coming at our bodies every second. And on a good day, the average human picks up on 40 of those. Mm. And it's consciously and unconsciously shifting based on information that we unconsciously perceive is important to our survival and important to structure our world. And that oftentimes is what is getting triggered. I think the emotional piece is partly downstairs brain, but also some of the higher brain functions. But another piece to the emotional side of this issue is that we are constantly being triggered by things that our downstairs brain has decided that are threats that is actually not based in reality necessarily.
You know, hang on. What? I know.
The crowd goes wild.
All right. So I'm a white person of European descent, and what I'm hearing today is nothing new, but I imagine that if it were, I would be sort of frozen and sort of fearful and feeling shame and guilt and oh my goodness. But I want to tell you about an experience that I had, and I was on radio work and I went into an organization. Now it happened to be a Hispanic organization, but it could have happened anywhere. And immediately when the woman saw me, and I don't know what this was about, she started to sort of take me on for my white heritage. And she doesn't know me. Why? And then she asked me, what's your ethnic background? And I said, I'm Irish. And everything shifted immediately. Mm. You are also from an oppressed culture. And I was so, it wasn't a relief by any means. It was further confusion about things. And so we all have these experiences. It doesn't matter from which group we're in. I'm not saying one is equal to another, but you had your hands up before. Have I stopped the flow of information, or do you want to talk more?
Well, a couple of things I wanted to talk on. One, I wanted to back up on what Susanna was saying, asking the question to white people, what if it were true? I actually have asked that question in workshops, and some of the responses I've got have been amazing. Mm-hmm. And one of the responses I get most often from white people when I say, what if it were true, is people stop and say, then that means that I'm not who I say I am, mm-hmm. and that the values, that I'm not living out the values that I say, that I say I hold. Mm. And I feel like for an awful lot of people, that's earth shaking.
The floor drops out.
The floor
There's no
drops
foundation.
Out. It absolutely does. And that, to me, is also one of the reasons why it's difficult to have this conversation, is because people don't want to get to the point where they're even thinking about that question, mm-hmm. or the ramifications of what it means. Because it is. It can disrupt your whole world. Mm-hmm. And as for what you were saying about your experience, I think that's interesting, because I also do a whole section on teaching people how to become allies for each other. And one of the things that I always caution white people is, you need to know, because of the history and treatment of people of color in this country, there is very much a chance that when you encounter a person of color, they're going to see you as
representative
of the people who have oppressed them, and you're not to take that on. You shouldn't feel shame, blame, and guilt if you didn't do it personally. But you also need to know that you have benefited from it, and that it's real, and you can't deny it. But you need to find a way to be able to, with them, work through it.
And you know what I felt was empathy. Ricky, you wanted to join, and we'll get it.
Yeah, I think, and I think the other part of this is one of the things we don't talk much about as white people is how we've been racialized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And racialization isn't just something that happens out there in the abstract. It's something that happens at home, happens in everyday life. Mm-hmm. When and just having done this a lot, that you know, one of the fears that always comes up for white people that I think is part of this too is yes, I'll be, what does it mean about who I am, but also what does it mean, and part of who I am is who I'm with, the relationships I have. Mm. What does it mean now for how I think about my spouse or my kids or my parents? And not just that, it's also because whites have seen what happens to other whites, what whites will do to other whites who do take on those ideas, who do see reality for what it is and will speak on it. They know that there will be consequences to that. They're already thinking, I could lose my relationship, or I could be alienated from my family, because they've already learned that's a constitutive part of becoming white. That part of what it means to be white is you have to restrict yourself racially in terms of your thought and your ideas in order to get love from other whites, from your family, from your spouse, so on and so on. So, you know, if you grow up having that connection in your being about that connection between race and love, you're going to have a lot of emotional stuff around it when somebody challenges you. And it's, again, it's not so much that you don't know what they're talking about. You know what they're talking about, and you know what it might mean if you actually agree with them and say, yes, I know what you're saying. I don't know how many times I've taught classes where I'll have whites just argue with me, and all of a sudden they're like, I give up. Okay, you're right. It exists. They get past the denial part, and all of a sudden they know all this stuff. They know all sorts of stuff. I'm not saying they know everything or know every historical thing that ever happened, but they have the general gist of what's going on. It's not new information. Again, there's no way you can live in this society and not see it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's less a it's less a knowledge problem than it is about a denial. It's more of an issue of, you know, how you deal with this in a psychological way.
Susanna, you want to add something?
Wow, there's so much here.
I know,
it's just so rich. Yeah.
Rich.
So I have kind of three things that are coming up for me. I really appreciate, Kathleen, your honesty and vulnerability talking about your experience. And it's a classic experience that a lot of white people have at some point. And what I invite people to explore when they have that experience is that's one of the rare occasions that a white person experiences being categorized as a member of a group. And that is the experience of people of color all day, every day, their entire life. Mm-hmm. So it's an excellent opportunity for a white person to have a moment of clarity and kind of go, wow, that didn't feel very good. I didn't like the way that that person made assumptions about who I am, what's in my soul based on a group that I belong to. And that happens every day, all day for people of color. Nelson talked during the show about collectivism and individualism, and that's one of the privileges that those of us that are white or look white carry, is that we get to be treated and perceived as individuals, mm-hmm. whereas people of color don't have that privilege. And I'm not sure where Nelson was going in terms of whether he thought collectivism was good or bad or why he thought that, but my personal belief is that, you know, if you look at some of the intercultural research that categorizes nations in terms of their cultural values, the U.S. continuously shows up at the top, not the very top, but among the top in terms of us being very individualistic. And I think we need to look at that also as a nation in terms of, is that serving us? Really, would a balance between individualism and collectivism better serve us as individuals and the group? The last thing I want to mention is the guilt and shame, anger and blame. Not so much the anger, but the guilt and shame and the blame sometimes comes from that freeze response, which has to do with a sense of powerlessness. Mm-hmm. It's a very easy place to go. When our downstairs brain is threatened, it's fight, flight, or freeze. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of white, and that's, you can see, how, and we saw that in the callers today, many of them fell into one of those categories. It's a natural response of our brain to stress, and it comes from a place often of powerlessness. What do I do with this information? And I think that's an important piece of the conversation that we have to forward, is not just building awareness and consciousness. I loved what you said earlier, Ricky, about knowledge versus consciousness, but awareness and knowledge, but then also skills. We've got to develop mm-hmm. skills at having this conversation. It's like we're trying to have this conversation like we're second graders. We lack the vocabulary. We lack the basic yes. emotion, the basic effective communication skills, not because we don't have communication skills, but because of the emotional barriers. And I think another piece of that that comes up for white people is that when we become aware of this dynamic and we get to a place of going past a denial and going, yeah, what if this were true? It implies responsibility. Yes. And I think a lot of times white people resist that because we'll say, well, my family didn't own slaves. You know, this is not my fault. It's not about that. It's about we are individuals, but we're also actors on a historical stage playing out dynamics that have happened thousands and thousands of times over hundreds of years. That was the context that was lacking from the Zimmerman trial, that mm-hmm. very much the whole discussion that race didn't play a part was ludicrous. Those two gentlemen were acting out a scenario that has played out over history hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of times. And just because I did not start that play or write that play doesn't mean that in this scene that we're acting out, I can't change the story. Yes. That I can't start to take responsibility, show up in new ways to move the conversation forward. And I think that's the invitation to white people to look at.
And Tanya, I know you want to continue, but I do want to say that experience for me was about 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was incredibly impactful. Now, I had other experiences prior to that as a musician, sometimes mm-hmm. being the only white person, but there was a sense of joy and creativity. It's just very different. This was an amazing, and I did have this realization, oh my gosh, this is what other people feel every day. Tanya, you yes. wanted to add on to what Susanna was saying.
And just one of the things that I wanted to say is that, yes, in talking about the guilt, shame, and blame, because that's a very, very mm-hmm. big deal in trying to work through this, is one of the things, and people will also often say to me, just my family didn't own slaves. And what I have to say to people is, you know, they probably didn't. And mm-hmm. you are still benefiting. You still have the white privilege that comes, that was brought about by the people who did own slaves. And so part of the way I try to talk to people about accepting this responsibility is you have a responsibility because you are benefiting from a system that holds a certain population of people down. You know,
even though it's right. not your fault right. and you didn't create right. okay. it, you still have you a still responsibility.
So what right. what is that responsibility? Is it to always be aware, to acknowledge injustice, to say to a policeman, hey, you didn't treat me that way because I've got white skin. What are you doing? I mean, is it speaking truth to power?
It's all of that and more, because one of the things that all of that does is raise consciousness. And as we were talking before, if you are not conscious, you can't help solve the problem. Police in this country are taught to see people of color as suspects. You know, as George Zimmerman said, when a white person says to them, wait a minute, you didn't do that to me, that makes them stop, and it makes them think, and it brings it to their consciousness. And if 100 white people did that, I guarantee you, then that cop is going to begin to looking at things a little bit different, because he has been forced to, because he has been challenged over and over and over again. That's one thing that you can do. You know, and there are all of those things that you said. You can do all of that and more. And I feel like there is a big risk to doing that, but at some level, it's got to be done.
All right, and hands up all around. But let's go to Ricky. We haven't heard from him in a bit.
Combine some of these things, you know, one of the places whites get trapped is in the guilt defensiveness cycle, like. on one hand denying everything, and then the next maybe saying, how can I apologize and make it better? You know, that kind of stuff. And part of the how whites racialize themselves, part of that is also talking about our history as white people, or how we distort our history as white people. And it happens in a number of ways. One of the main issues is that we don't teach ourselves about the history of white anti-racist people or white anti-racist mm-hmm. groups. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm as critical of whites as probably anyone, but as a white person. But I also know that there's been whites who haven't gone along with it. Mm-hmm. There's whites who've resisted. There's whites who have risked their lives. John Brown. You know, one of the famous, more famous people doing that. And in textbooks, you know, we're the ones writing the textbooks, but how do we depict John Brown? He was crazy. Mm-hmm. He's insane. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, a white person must be crazy to want to risk their lives for the humanity of not just people of color, but for white people, too.
Well, and talk about John Brown a little bit. Explain a little bit about who he is.
I may not know the whole history as well as some other folks, but... what was it, the raid on in West Virginia? Mm-hmm. What's the place?
Ferry,
Bonner's Ferry? Yeah. So basically, you know, being part of a revolt to try to free slaves, you know, and in the process was captured and then hung. So I just think that, you know, when we're talking about the, you know, whites are going to hear this or hear if they go to anti-racist training. There is a lot of fear. There's a sense that, okay, if I go this route, I'm going to be alone. I'm going to be isolated. And there is some of that. Because, you know, you will be pushed away by other whites. But the thing then is, well, what could you become? What else could you be? Mm-hmm. And we need to put those other images out there. Not just images, actual role models. There are current role models. There's some in the room. You know, here's what you can do. Here's another way of being. And it's important to learn that from other whites who have done the work in the past, historically, and currently, because while you can make alliances with people of color doing anti-racist work, you're still a white person. And that still means something different, being a white person as an anti-racist than being a person of color as an anti-racist. You know, like, like with me, I'll get, you know, people will respond to me differently because I'm a white guy. Or I get invited to do certain kinds of talks that they wouldn't invite somebody else to come do, mm-hmm. you know. So it doesn't go away just because you're all of a sudden trying to become an anti-racist. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's any time you have any kind of conversation or issue that is difficult, it's almost always easier to talk about it, to engage with somebody who looks like you. Mm-hmm. And so that is a role that white people will always have. There are places that Ricky gets invited to go that they would never have me as a black woman in a million years.
Is it the flip as well, that you get invited places that he wouldn't be invited?
Not usually.
Okay.
Not usually, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's not because in the flip situation, it's a novelty. To have him.
Right.
But I feel like there is always a role for white people because white people can get in a whole lot of doors that I can't get into.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, Susanna, you wanted to add something.
I did. And I think that question about responsibility is one that is super important. And I'm noticing that we're not giving a lot of specifics. And I think that's because there's so much and it's complex and it's constantly changing. But I think that is part of the conversations that white people need to have with each other and with people of color in terms of, and then also figuring out what's a good fit for them. What can I take responsibility for and what do I need to kind of let go at this point? But in my mind, there's some basics in terms of starting to develop connections between your downstairs brain and your upstairs brain which is difficult because a lot of people don't realize this, but there are no direct connections between our higher brain function and our prefrontal cortex and our reptilian brain. That's why we can go so quickly be triggered and why it takes time and effort to bring in our higher reasoning functions when we've been emotionally triggered. But this takes practice. You can find ways to disrupt your immediate reactions to things. Start to notice with compassion, curiosity, and humor the ways that we are enjoying privilege, ways that we can disrupt what's going on, ways that we can build our emotional intelligence and our effective communication skills and our resilience to have the conversation. And the key piece here is also looking at, acknowledging, and using power. One of the things that I think makes this conversation and the responsibility difficult for white people in the United States is because the U.S., as it is today as a European 200-year-old nation, was founded on values such as equality that make it very difficult for us to even acknowledge that we have tremendous power inequities in our country. I don't see a lot of my experience personally and professionally and academically has been in Mexico and Latin America. In a lot of those older cultures and in other parts of the world as well, power is something that's acknowledged, that's worked with, that's out in the open. In the United States, because we have a belief that inequality is the way that we live our lives, we don't like to think about, talk about, or acknowledge power. And I think that's one of the barriers. So what white people need to do is to, instead of denying that we have power, get to a place where we can acknowledge and notice where and how we have power and use that power as a force for good instead of evil. And you know, again, those are loaded terms. But when I say good, I mean to disrupt the status quo and disrupt the way that things are playing out. And that can be everything from calling out individual behaviors and noticing what's happening in a dynamic and making mindful, powerful decisions about how to interact and do that differently, to getting involved in a more macro systemic way at changing the way that the system unequally impacts people of color.
You know, again, rich beyond belief here, but one of the things I was thinking about this morning is the media and the media's impact. And there's a great comparison on Huffington Post about 2 7-year-old boys, I don't know if you've seen this, who both took a car joyriding, and the white boy was interviewed on the Today Show. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're just a prankster. Mm-hmm. I wanted to feel. And the black boy was made out to be a criminal. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen that, I recommend it to anybody who's here or who's listening. But, what came to mind for me this morning was just this incredible shift that I believe needs to take place when we're talking about acknowledging power, acknowledging responsibility. The media tells us all we have to get ahead, get ahead, get ahead of the next person, get more, get better. And the shift that I am looking for is never mind get ahead, get together. Mm-hmm. And I put that out on Facebook.
That's the collectivism
piece.
Imagine.
Well, okay, but collectivism in the positive sense. Because I said, imagine if instead of getting ahead, we got, you know, our thought process was get together. And so, Tanya.
It's interesting that you were talking about, because I saw the same thing. What it made me think of as a black woman was partially going back to the Trayvon Martin thing, was how we have always had to teach our children that they have to walk differently in the world because the world sees them differently. I can remember hearing my parents have this talk with my brother saying, you have to be very careful because what will be perceived by white people of a white boy doing exactly what you said, that's cute, that's whatever, will get you as a black boy killed or put in jail or what have you. And that one of the problems that came up with very, very big in the Trayvon case was, once again, we are reminded of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? An awful lot of white people are seeing that for the first time. Mm. This is our history.
Well, and Jim, our caller, who has an African-American son, but he said he feels ill-equipped.
Yes,
because he is.
What is he supposed to say? Yeah, what is he supposed to say? Let's go ahead. I was going to wrap up, but there's too much going on. All right, go ahead. And then Susanna, and then I'm going to get to Ricky.
Yeah, I think the walk together metaphor is a really good one, and I think a point that sometimes gets lost in the work that I do that's often termed diversity and inclusiveness, which is a whole nother conversation in terms of what those words mean and how that plays out, but is oftentimes by organizations and clients of mine seen as the good thing to do or the right thing to do. And when we talk about walking together, it's sort of seen as this is good and this is right. But what gets lost is the very real data that shows that we, when we are together and when we have difference at the table, and that includes race, but a bunch of other things as well, we get better results. It's an evolutionary advantage for us as a species. They're not mutually exclusive. You don't have to choose between togetherness and excellence. You don't have to choose between doing the right thing and brilliance. Research shows that you get excellence and brilliance out of diversity. Diverse groups outperform non-diverse groups, individuals, and even a group of the experts, as long as there is effective communication, which is why we occasionally see articles in the media talking about, oh, we've now proven diversity doesn't work. There's all these bad things that are happening. That's because when you just have diversity, when you just have difference together, co-creating, this kind of goes back to the Brown versus Board of Education, you actually see a reduction in social cohesion, morale, productivity, results, because you have to have the effective communication and the positive relationships. But once you have that, the diverse group outperforms even the experts. So this makes us all better. In the United States, we very much always think in binaries. It's not like this around the world in all cultures. We think this or that, black or white, male or female, Democrats or Republicans. And that, I think, is another barrier to us really thinking about it's both and. It's togetherness, not because it's the right thing to do, but because it benefits all of us, not just people of color, but whites as well.
And is that some of the work that you do, setting, finding effective communication tools, helping people develop those? Ricky, I wanted to sort of wrap up by seeing where we need to go from here. But if you wanted to add something before
the thing about the sort of discourse, the talk about individuality, I don't know what, I don't think anybody who says that really believes it. I think they know that. Like, I'm assuming some of the callers, if I asked them, are we Americans, would say yes. Okay, isn't that a collective? I mean, I don't think anybody really believes that we're only just about individualism. So the question then is, which collective do we want to be part of and on and work on behalf of? It's a way of divert, it's a common tactic to try to divert from the reality that, yes, you imagine yourself as part of some collectives. the thing about stereotypes, I mean, that's a word that I sometimes even don't use the word stereotype. I think it's the meaning of it is not really accurate to what's going on. It means like a fixed type. The thing, though, is that historically whites have created different images of others depending on what their political needs are for a certain historical era. During slavery, blacks were depicted as like childlike and not capable intellectually, sort of feeble-minded, because that was the argument that, well, we need plantation masters to take care of them because they're too, they can't take care of themselves in society, Now, that changed afterwards when blacks were part of the larger workforce. They became a threat to whites in the workforce. So the idea of being dangerous or criminal came about. That wasn't there during slavery because, it just didn't serve the function. To me, a word like controlling image is something that is more meaningful to me because it suggests that these images serve a certain function. They're taken up for certain purposes. I don't think stereotypes are just things that we internalize. There's all sorts of things that are put out in the media or through mass communication that we reject, there's all sorts of things. But yet some things we choose to internalize. It doesn't just happen passively. If you think your interest somewhere in there, whether it's conscious, unconscious, probably a mix of both, that having this image of a certain group of people is going to serve you somehow, whether that's getting things materially or getting love from your family, whatever that is, you might then embrace that, even though you probably know somewhere deep down it's probably not true.
So how do we move forward with all of this? How do we? I mean, we've had this conversation today. We've actually continued the conversation. Several people have to move on, but so just quickly around the table, how do we move forward? What's the best way?
Well, for me, there's a lot of approaches to this, and it's hard to know because, you know, it's a new thing. We haven't undone it in the past, so we're inventing something. We created something bad in humanity, and we haven't figured out how to undo it yet. We created it, especially Europeans, 500 years ago, and implemented this worldwide system that, you know, is based on race, and we haven't figured out how to undo it. But one place to look, at least just one piece to start for whites, one that I would point people towards, is to learn about yourself as a white person. What does it mean to be a white person? Don't, you know, the first thing doesn't have to be running out and finding people of color to tell you what's real in the world. Just accept that it's true and say, okay, how has this shaped me? How has this thing called whiteness shaped me as a white person? How does it shape what I discard? How does it shape how I respond to people? How does it shape why I, when looking for a house, I'm choosing to go here on this side of town and not that side of town? How does it shape me? What does it mean to be a white person in a society where white is the higher status, dominant position?
So an examined life, live an examined life. Susanna, you said you have to take off, so let's go ahead and go to you. Just how do we move forward?
Yeah, I think just sort of what I said earlier and also what my colleagues have been saying, the piece that I think gets lost a lot, again, is the building internal emotional intelligence and resilience to be able to have these conversations and to look at these other realities that we are so inclined to deny. I think that's a big piece. And in terms of actions to do, once you have that awareness and that emotional intelligence and that resilience are myriad and diverse. But, you know, I'm a big proponent for really digging down into the six C's, which I talked about a few in my TED Talk, but courage, consciousness, compassion, control, these types of things that build our internal effectiveness and our internal ability to then go out into the world, be more conscious of how we're thinking, how we're feeling, having compassion and empathy for ourselves and for others, and to then make more mindful decisions and choices about behaviors that actually co-create a world that works better for everyone, including ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And Tanya, you're our anchor here on our relay. Would you like us all to move forward?
I have to say I agree with what's been said, and especially with what Ricky was saying. This is new. It has not been done before. So we're sort of inventing it as we go along. And I'm one of those people who never believes there's only one right way of doing anything. There are many different ways of doing it, and it depends on who the people are and what their values are and what ideas they come up with. One of the things I think is so wonderful and remarkable about people here is that when we get together and decide that we're going to do something, I feel like almost nothing can stop us. We just need to come together and do that, and we will figure out a dozen different ways, maybe 100 different ways to work on solving the problem. And I think that most of them will all be valid. We just need to do it.
We keep our minds and our hearts open.
Many
thanks to all of you. This has been amazing that you've stuck around and continued this conversation. Yeah. And for Oman, our engineer, we really appreciate it. We've been talking with Ricky Lee Allen, Susan Rinderly.
Susanna.
I knew it would happen. And Tanya Covington. I'm Kathleen Sabo. Thank you for listening to KUNM.